Hey, folks, introducing the perfect companion to the Jim Jefferies Show, which has been grabbing late night by the country. It's the Jim Jefferies Show podcast. If you don't know him, you should. Jim Jefferies is an Australian comedian with an inquisitive and sometimes controversial take on American politics and culture. On his new podcast, you'll get a behind-the-scenes look at what happened on the show, including jokes that weren't used or backstory on Jim's international field pieces. You won't want to miss it, folks. Listen to new episodes of the Jim Jefferies Show podcast, releasing every Wednesday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, the Emmy and Golden Globe winning comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm returns for its 10-episode ninth season this Sunday, October 1st at 10 p.m. Eastern on HBO. Seinfeld co-creator Larry David is an over-the-top version of himself in an unsparing but tongue-in-cheek depiction of his life. The new season and brings back Cheryl Hines, Jeff Garland, Susie Essman, and J.B. Smoove as Leon, as well as series favorites Richard Lewis, Bob Einstein, Ted Danson, and Mary Steenburgen. Catch the return of Curb Your Enthusiasm on Sunday, October 1st at 10 p.m. Eastern on HBO. Okay? All right. Dig it.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck, Nicks? What is happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Today on the show, I talked to Tom Colicchio, the Top Chef guy. You know him, the chef guy from Top Chef. I think we just wanted to chat. I like chefs. I haven't talked to a chef in a while. In another life, I wanted to be a chef. I believe I could do it. But anyways, there's a couple things I want to tell you about, if I could, because I have the platform here to do it. If you want to come out and see me and Brendan McDonald as we are out and about with the new book, Waiting for the Punch, we have events in New York and San Francisco so far, up to this point. That's where we got. In New York City, we'll be at the Union Square, Barnes & Noble on Tuesday, October 10th at 7 p.m. You don't need tickets for that. In San Francisco, we'll be at the Alamo Draft House on Friday, October 13th as part of Litquake. You do need tickets for that one. Go to litquake.org to get them. And if you want to win a king-size Casper mattress or get a brand new luggage set from Away or get some signed posters from me, pre-order Waiting for the Punch and then upload your proof of purchase to enter our sweepstakes. Go to markmaronbook.com to pre-order now. All right? You want to do that? Can you do it? So I got to, you know what? I wanted to bring this up because, Pete Davidson was on the show on Monday, and it was an amazing conversation. It was a very candid conversation, a very forthright conversation about mental health, his mental health issues, mine to a lesser degree. We talked about his borderline personality disorder. And here's the fucking fucked up thing about our culture is that the interview got turned into a lot of clickbait by all the usual places, all the garbage outlets. You know, the portals of psychic garbage that we are allowed into our fucking brains through our eye holes. And, the headlines were almost all sensationalistic, making it sound like he was in a crisis or something. And it wasn't the case. He was having an honest, respectful conversation with me about mental health, which is something people in this country are hesitant to do because the shitty tabloid culture stigmatizes it and makes it seem wrong. It's just a shame that people would take it out of that context and sensationalize it. You know, that it was just an honest conversation. And it's just, fuck it, man. It's the opposite of helpful. It makes people less likely to get help, less likely to feel like they are okay. It's just fucking irresponsible. And I just wanted to put that out there because Pete did a brave thing and he's a good kid, that Pete. And he's doing all right. That's what I got to say. All right? People got to talk about mental health. You keep hiding shit, everything is a lie. And the entire cultural dialogue is a big lie, and everyone's afraid to talk because they're going to be exploited or bullied or ripped apart or ostracized. Man, are we going to make this experiment work? Can we be a fucking community? of humans in this country? Is it possible? All odds are against us right now. But on the upside, we're sponsored today by Sonos. And I love Sonos because I love listening to music and it all sounds great on my Sonos speakers. But now Sonos has also improved my TV watching experience, folks. Ever since I got Playbase, everything sounds better on Playbase, a speaker system that adds dynamic, pulse-pounding sound to whatever's playing on your TV. Like even interstitial noises. You know, like when they go away to break or come back from break, they're like little things just permeate your skin. That's how good the sound is, permeates your skin. It's designed, I just turned into Brian Regan for a minute. It's designed to sit right under your TV so you barely even notice it while it's filling your room with epic home theater audio. And it's not just for TV. Playbase can also stream your favorite music. You can also add other Sonos speakers from other rooms to it. They sync up wirelessly. Right now, for the first time ever, Sonos is offering WTF listeners 10% off your order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. Just use the promo code WTF 10 at Sonos.com to receive this exclusive offer. That's WTF and the number 10 at Sonos.com. Okay? Dig it. So what's happening? I got some feedback on the size of my new friendly feral stray cat's face. I told you about Big Head. I told you about that, you know, he has this huge head, but he also has this huge set of balls, which needs to be taken care of. And I guess that's on me. I don't know if he's domesticated, but he's pleasant sometimes. He's an odd cat. He looks like he's got this big old head and these big old balls and, you know, and his body looks like a bicep. Like he's just this little monster. And I like him all right, but he's a little erratic. You can touch him. You can pet him. But sometimes when you're petting him, he hisses. Like you don't know if he's hissing in pleasure. Generally with a cat, it's not pleasure. And he attacked me the other day. And I went out, hit my Sarah the painter, my girlfriend, thinks it had something to do with my balls. Because I went out there naked to feed him, which I do sometimes in the morning out back. No one can see me. I'll go out naked and put the food down. And that little fucker, Big Head, attacked my leg and bit my leg. He bit my fucking leg out of nowhere. As I was walking away, after I picked up the bowl to fill it with food, he attacked me, bit my leg. And Sarah's like, well, that's because, you know, he saw your balls and, you know, he saw you as a threat, you know, of his territorial threat. Like, we had a little cockfight. I had a cockfight with the cat. And I did not attack him back. I let him win that one. But to the question about the connection between balls and head, I got a few emails sort of putting it together. But this was the first one from Allison. Subject line, cat balls. I was listening to today's podcast and I had to stop what I was doing. Juicing prickly pears, there's magenta shit all over my kitchen. To answer your inquiry about the relationship between cat cheeks and testicles, I'm a vet who works at an animal shelter, so I have the pleasure of working with a variety of cat testicles of all shapes and sizes. The answer is that Sarah the painter is right, of course, in parentheses. Cheek/jowl size is a testosterone-dependent trait in male cats. Cats who are neutered before 1 to 2 years of age will never develop jowls. And if they are neutered later in life, the jowls will stay, but will get saggier once the testosterone disappears. Isn't that the way with everything, though? Anyway, basically, there's a direct relationship between the size of a cat's balls and the size of its cheeks. Get that majestic beast neutered. Thank you for everything you do for your outdoor colony. Keep telling cat stories. Boomer and Deaf Black Cat, 4E, forever. Got it. I just had to figure that out in real time. 4E, forever. 4E is forever. Well, thank you, Allison, for clearing that up. Now we know why I have jowls. It's because of my balls. Oh, wait. No, I meant the cat. I meant that's why the cat had jowls. There's another email here that I'd like to read you because I think it's encouraging and important, and I believe it's real. Sometimes I get emails that are not real. They're just people fucking with me. But this one sounded real. And it sounded, I don't know, it was encouraging. I don't think it's going to take the country by storm, but it would be nice if it would. This is from William. Bill, subject line, I'm sorry, I've made a huge mistake. Hey, Mark, I just watched Too Real on Netflix. That's my special, by the way, which you can watch on Netflix. I must admit, this is the first time I've ever watched a comedy special. Great job. It was very funny. I guess I owe you and the country an apology. So here it goes. I'm sorry. I voted for Trump. I'd take it back if I could. As Gob from Arrested Development frequently says, I've made a huge mistake. I'm 44 years old and I was a conservative talk radio Fox News junkie since high school. After 25 plus years of living in the echo chamber, I finally broken free. The Donald has managed to do what no one and nothing else has been able to do. I'm off of conservative talk radio and off of Fox News. Just couldn't listen to one more sycophantic broadcast praising and or excusing inexcusable positions, policies, and tweets. I've been amazed at how much more open and receptive to new views and opinions I've become since stepping back from the spin machine. I'm not ready to vote a straight Democratic ticket, but I no longer dismiss news and views from the other side. Your WTF podcast has been an important part of this transition for me. It's been super healthy to get new views from someone I enjoy listening to. My brother-in-law introduced me to your podcast this past spring. A couple of highlights for me have been the Al Franken interview and the President Obama interview. Keep up the great work. Thanks, Bill. See, that's basic logic without even being political, is that when you see people that you've grown to trust, support behavior and ideas and actions that are heinous, you have to question the whole goddamn operation, don't you? Well, Bill, I appreciate that. I appreciate you you sending that, and I believe you, and I have to assume that others are somewhat sensing that. It's a real shit show. It's a real history changing, brain bending, completely terrifying shit show, a fucking circus of corruption and greed and racism and violence. Hey, but cooking's great. I love to cook. I want to get better at cooking. Occasionally I'll have a chef in here, get some tips, but you know, you can go look that stuff up. I love to cook because it takes me out of me. And like sometimes when I have time off, like I've had over the summer, I'll spend a lot of time doing food prep, doing cooking, making things I enjoy. I'll spend hours and hours making, you know, beautiful food that I like to eat, that's healthy, hours and hours of prep, days of working on the food, and I will eat it in minutes, in fucking minutes. And I cannot seem to not do that. Oh, did I mention today is my birthday, which will be yesterday when you hear this? I recorded this Wednesday, and if you're listening to it Thursday, I will have turned 54 already. I'm 54 years old. I woke up 54 this morning, and I feel all right. I feel okay. I don't make a big deal out of it. I'm going to dinner with Sarah the painter. Got some nice calls. Appreciate all the well-wishers on Twitter and email. Thank you. I made it another year. I've had 54 in a row now with no breaks. Got close to taking a break, but I kept at it. I kept at this life thing. So look, let's listen to me and Tom Colicchio, the Top Chef guy. He's a Jersey guy. And as you know, I'm genetically Jersey. So this is me and Tom talking. All right, you just walked in. You're talking about a restaurant down, where is it, Necco Park? Silver Lake.
Silver Lake, Squirrel. Yeah, Squirrel, yeah.
I've been there, I think, once. I don't know. But I have to assume that when you walk into a restaurant, they're like, holy shit, Tom's here. How do you pronounce your last name?
Colicchio.
Colicchio. Yeah. Tom Colicchio just walked in. So there's panic in the kitchen.
No. So last night we did a 10th anniversary party at Kraft, my restaurant here in Los Angeles.
I've been there.
And Jessica Caslow, who owns and is a chef at Squirrel, She cooked with me last night. Johnny and Vinny as well, and Ludo. And
you're dropping names. Johnny and Vinny, yeah, they're your guys over there?
No, the guys that own Animal.
Okay. I've been there.
Yeah. And so Jessica knew I was coming, and that does happen, I guess.
you never drop in just to drop in?
I do. A lot of times I don't want to be known. I just kind of drop in, you know. That's just kind of try to sneak in and just have it. Because, you know, the problem is we chefs, we go into each other's restaurants and we call food fucked.
Yeah.
You know, just too much food starts coming out and you feel obliged that you have to eat it all. And before you know it, you're rolling out of there, you know, 10 pounds heavier than when you walked in. You feel like shit.
That's happened to me, and I'm not a chef.
Right.
If I go to, like, I like Alex Guarnicelli, right?
Yeah,
so
sure.
I go to a restaurant, and she'll know I'm coming, and then they start, you know, doing chef's table kind of stuff, and you're like, oh, my God.
And before you know it, you're just like...
9 desserts.
I'm ill.
Like, were they trying to kill me? I imagine with you, it's like, I know what's happening. They're trying to kill me.
They're trying to kill me, exactly.
Get me out of the way.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But, so what's her name over there at Squirrel?
Jessica Kozlov.
Now, what makes her, like, I'm just curious because, like, I can cook, but I'm not a chef. And I'd like to be, but I didn't go that way.
Usually after that you get, I'm not a chef, but I have a wok.
Yeah. And I have a wok pan.
Right.
Yeah. And because it's easy to saute in, not because I wok cook.
Uh-huh.
But, like, when you say, what makes her stylistically interesting?
You know,
chef?
She's doing food that I think, at least that I want to eat now. There's a certain freshness to it, a certain immediacy to it. And it's just damn delicious.
Yeah.
I mean, she does this rice, salad with this egg on it, this crispy rice salad with the egg on it for breakfast. And it's just, I can eat it every day of the week.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
But now that's not something you would think of.
No, it's not the kind of food that I cook.
Yeah.
And that's probably why I like it. She did this thing last night that was so cool. She did cabbage.
Yeah.
Right. And braised cabbage, and so it was kind of seared a little bit, and a big wedge of cabbage.
Braised
and
then in what?
Well, she basted it, so she seared it first in a lot of butter, and then started basting it in sauerkraut juice.
Huh.
And then took dehydrated sauerkraut juice and used it as a garnish, and then some chive blossoms, garlic chive blossoms, and fried preserved lemons. It was just absolutely delicious.
Now, when you, like, just saying that, like, you know, I understand the logic of it and the aesthetic of it, and that it's like a mildly crowded cabbage, braised cabbage with lemon and whatever. Yeah. But do you just marvel at the ingenuity of that?
No, actually, the simplicity of it. This is, you know, when you get down to it, it's a wedge of braised cabbage.
Right.
But it's just, it's not about how, it's always about what.
Uh-huh.
You know, or not about what, it's about how.
Yeah.
It's not that you braised cabbage, how did you braise it?
Right.
What did you do there? You did something a little different.
But it seems like creative, like it seems like outside the box. Dehydrated sauerkraut juice.
Yeah, listen, it's absolutely creative and out of the box, but at the same time,
simple.
Really simple and basic too.
Now, where'd you grow up?
New Jersey.
Where?
Elizabeth.
Yeah, you know, my grandfather is from Elizabeth.
My uncle said everybody's from Elizabeth. If you search back and you go back, someone in your family's from Elizabeth.
Why is that?
I don't know.
Did they all come in that way?
Yeah, I think you know, from Ellis Island, if you went left on the river, you went to New York, and you take a right, you went to New Jersey.
And you're right there. You're at Elizabeth.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a nice place. How old are you?
55.
You have family there still?
No, I think I have one cousin left.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But what was it like there when you grew up? What was the business?
Yeah, my father he had a barber shop when we were young, and then he...
In the house?
Yeah. No, not in the house. No, uh-huh. He had a shop. And then I think he lost it paying a gambling debt, I think. something they didn't talk about.
Some gangster got the shop?
I don't know, something like that. But anyways, he was a correction officer in a county jail.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's heavy.
Yeah.
Coming home from that, he went from barber to corrections officer.
Yeah, exactly.
In the county jail.
Yeah, I think it was one of those things where he was still young and it was 20 and out. And you know,
And then he did that his whole life?
He did, and he actually passed away before he retired. He was 52 when he passed away, so it was 28
years
ago. Oh, my God. Yeah, he was young.
Of what?
Lung cancer.
Oh, smoked?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
A lot.
Yeah. You just grow up with that, I guess. You know, that's the world that you lived in then.
Yeah. He started smoking when he was a teenager, probably, and he was good for a good 2 to 3 packs a day.
Wow. Yeah. Did you ever do it?
I did. I you know, it's funny. My first trip to Los Angeles, I wasn't crazy about it, but I was 24 years old, and the only good thing that came out of it is I never smoked a cigarette again after that trip.
Oh, really?
I was 24 years old.
And you'd been smoking?
I'd been smoking, probably a good pack a day.
Yeah.
And I was here, I was working just for a couple of weeks, and I was staying in a motel somewhere, and I had to walk up two flights of stairs, and I was out of breath. I was 24, and I was like, fuck this.
Oh, really?
I gotta stop this. I never smoked a cigarette again.
It scared
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what do you mean just out here working for a couple of weeks? You weren't a chef then?
Yeah, I was a sous chef in a restaurant in New York called Quilted Giraffe, and we had three weeks off in August.
Yeah.
And so I asked the chef there that I was working for to, you know, get me out to Los Angeles to, you know, cook, and so he sent me out here to work at a restaurant called Rex. And a big old Italian restaurant. And I spent about a week in the kitchen and said, I got to get out of here. And
that was it.
And so I took whatever money I had and ate around and then hightailed it back home.
So, like, when you grew up, how many siblings do you have?
Two. I have an older brother and a younger brother.
Okay, so there's three. You're Italian, full on. Yeah. Your mom is, what does she do?
My mom, you know, she just took care of us when we were young. And then she, you know, in the first job she had at the house, she worked at like a photo store or something like that, you know, helping process film. But then she started working in a school cafeteria. She managed a school cafeteria.
So this is straight up working class family.
Yeah. I shared a bedroom with my two brothers.
For the whole time?
Oh, yeah, until I left when I was 18. Yeah, exactly.
But like, what is, cause like, I was talking to Frank about it. Frank's an Italian kid from New Jersey, mm-hmm. my part-time assistant guy. And it seems to me that there was a time where you could go, like, anywhere in New Jersey and Philadelphia and in that area where you can find a pretty good Italian restaurant almost every other block.
You're a Jersey guy, right?
Well, I mean, my mother's Pompton Lakes, my father's Jersey City, but I didn't grow up there.
Got it.
You know, we were out by the time I was six, genetically, I'm Jersey.
Right. So, no, there's in our town, there was an Italian restaurant that was there forever called Spirito's.
Yeah.
And that's where we would go. My father would take us there on Fridays.
Yeah.
He would play softball, and then we'd go there. And they had, you know, decent pizza. They had great veal cutlet and ravioli.
Yeah.
It wasn't veal cutlet parmesan. It was just fried veal cutlet with sauce and then ravioli on the side.
Yeah.
And that's what we ate. We had an Italian salad. And if they felt like splurging, we would get the imported provolone cheese, not the domestic stuff.
Yeah. But it was good, right?
Yeah. And the restaurant's still there.
It's still there.
It's still there, yeah.
Now, what is the difference? Like, because I what do you think? Okay, let's talk Italian food here. Now,
I don't go to too many restaurants here, but I'll give it a shot. I don't know restaurants here that well.
No, I don't either, dude. Yeah. But I mean, I'm of the belief that we don't have top notch Italian here. Angelini's Osteria is good.
Yeah.
And I guess Mario's place is good.
Moza, you know.
But I only ate there once.
Right.
But like, there's no...
Like the old school, like Dentana and places like that.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
Yeah, it's kind of old school Italian.
But I don't know if there was a huge Italian contingent here like there was. Like, they were all in Jersey and Philly.
Well, they were in San Francisco.
Yeah?
They were all up north. Yeah.
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 What, so that's where the Italian is?
Yeah, I think so. Listen, I'm sure there's a million people now that are going to be like jumping down my throat going, what do you mean?
How do you not eat there?
We're good Italian restaurants. There are great Italian restaurants here.
That's probably true.
Yeah, there are. I just don't know them.
So how do you go, what drives you to cook? Did you love it when you were a kid? I mean,
I was...
Do you have a knack for it?
Yeah, I did, actually. I was about 13, 12 or 13, and I started cooking and doing simple stuff. Like, I watched my mom make pancakes and said, well, that's pretty damn easy to do. I think I can handle that.
It's kind of fun, though. It's immediate kind of...
And then I was... got about the best job I ever had. I was 13 years old, and we belonged to a swim club, an Italian-American swim club in Clark, New Jersey, called the Grand Centurions.
Yeah.
And they had a snack bar type thing.
Yeah.
And the guy hired me there to scoop ice cream and run the cash register. And within a week, I was cooking. Doing like grilled cheese and burgers and steak sandwiches and sausage, stuff like that. And I just loved it. This guy was paying me $275 a week under the table, and I work in a pair of flip-flops, shorts and a flip-flops, maybe a shirt sometimes. Yeah. It was great. And I just
because you're
just,
on the grill.
Yeah, I just loved it. And so I found it was easy.
It's engaging though.
It was very easy. I understood it and you know, I had a problem with like dealing with recipes, looking at recipes and trying to figure out recipes. I most likely would have been diagnosed with ADD and I would kind of just stumble upon them. And then I got this book. I think I was about 15 and my dad came home and he said he got it in the library. So I'm not sure what the hell this book was doing in the jail's library.
Yeah.
But it was Jacques Pepin.
Yeah.
And it was a book called La Technique.
Yeah.
And he just talked about how cooking isn't about recipes. It's about techniques.
Yeah.
And once you learn techniques, you can throw the recipe book out and just do whatever you want.
Is that true?
Absolutely. It freed me up completely. Listen, it's like playing guitar, right?
Yeah.
Before you get creative on a guitar, you have to know the basics, right?
Yeah.
And then once you understand how to, you know, if you can get one, you know, a pattern down for
you learn a couple scales. You can
scales, yeah. Once you get it, you know, if you can play a pentatonic scale, I mean, you can do a lot.
Sure, right? That's exactly right. But like, so okay, so what? So you're 15 and you read that book.
Yep.
And what are the basics?
Well, the basics were, you know, I never know how you guys... how do you cook a green vegetable? It's the same, no matter what green vegetable it is. How do you make a good stock? How do you make a, you know, a couple of mother sauces, and then you can go from there?
Yeah.
You know, how do you butcher a few things?
Yeah.
And you know, you get some basics, and then you can kind of do whatever you want.
How do you cook a green vegetable? You blanch it?
Well, yeah, exactly. In boiling water, you don't cover the pot. You make sure it's salted.
Yeah.
You know, those are basics.
Keep it quick, and then you can saute after that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
So, yeah. And so one, and then, and...
Do you blanch broccoli, Rob?
Yes and no. It all depends. Depends on what I'm doing with it.
Okay.
But it depends. Do I want that roasted flavor, or do I want like a fresh green flavor?
Right. So, okay. So, right. So if you're roasting it, you just roast it.
If I'm roasting it straight up, I'll roast it, but then I'll be getting a different flavor.
Okay.
But that's, you know, that's exactly right. So how do you treat each thing, and what's the effect that you're looking for?
I just want to throw a very specific question.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, I just found that cooking was easy. It came easy, and I enjoyed it. And my dad, I guess, suggested, and wasn't, I listened to him that often, but he suggested I become a chef. And I was like, all right, sounds cool.
If he's into it,
yeah,
if I got his support. But like, but you know, cause like I cooked, I did some grill cooking when I was younger. I was not good at it, and I couldn't handle, like I fucked up a few times in restaurants, but I liked the excitement of it.
Yeah. Oh, I did too.
Like you got all those dupes up and you're just sweaty and you're like,
there's nothing like it, man. When it's busy, you walk into a busy kitchen. I have a steakhouse in Vegas, and I walk in there, and it's a busy, busy place. And I walk in and just kind of, all right, guys, keep doing what you're doing, because I can't figure it out. It's like,
really?
No, it's insane.
Yeah. There's just, what is it? Got a big line? Like there's a line in back.
Well,
you got to
two. We have side by side.
Yeah.
And there's just so, you know, there's just a pile of meat cooking at any time. It's great. It's awesome to see.
Which restaurant's that?
It's called Kraft Steak.
Kraft Steak. And, yeah. Oh, and what is
Vegas.
It? Which hotel?
The MGM.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
But okay, so what do you, so you got the knack, you got the basics from Jacques Pepin. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Do you go to school?
No, I plan on going to culinary school. And at the time, you had to work in two restaurants before they'd accept you. And so, you know, I fill out the application and the whole bit, and I started
for
working.
For which one?
Culinary Institute of America. Yeah. And then I started working around, and I think this is my fourth restaurant job. I finally decided to take a shot at cooking in New York.
Yeah.
And I was at the Quilted Giraffe, which was a 4-star restaurant, considered one of the best in New York, maybe in the United States.
The
Quilted Giraffe. Yeah. And within 4 months, I was a sous chef there. And at that point, I was like, I'm like.
So you just get a gig, you get the job as a what?
Well, my first serious restaurant job was at a restaurant in Elizabeth called Evelyn's. It was a seafood restaurant. We would do 1,000 covers on a Saturday night. It was just insane. But it also, you know.
Fresh fish.
Well, kind of. but it also opened me up to the restaurant world. You know, I was a 17-year-old kid, and there was a lot of like,
the restaurant,
you know, older waitresses around.
Sure.
They were older, like 23, 24, going to college.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of, I had a lot of fun.
And just that kitchen too, right?
There was nothing like it. I mean, it's just.
When I used to tell a story about that, when you've just gotten through a lunch rush or a dinner rush, and you're out back just covered in grease, smoking a cigarette.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. Yeah. And we and, you know, I was going to the, I mean, then the drinking age was 18.
Right.
So, you know, you'd go out with your friends after work and just, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just
get wasted.
Totally inebriated. Yeah, and manage to wake up.
Break into the restaurant to eat.
Yes. There's stuff like, yeah, exactly. yeah, you've been there, huh?
Yeah.
And so, but anyway, that was the first job. And then from there, I moved to. And I worked in, on the line. I worked in the bakery. I worked in the prep kitchen.
So you understood it all.
Yeah. And then I ended up going to a Red Sauce Italian restaurant in Union, New Jersey.
Oh.
And then from there, went to a hotel to try that out.
Red Sauce Italian restaurant? What is this? That's a way of, that's a certain type of Italian?
Well, yeah, it's the Red
One
Sauce
red
Italian.
Sauce,
not that Northern Italian
right,
stuff.
Right, right. Not the whiter sauces.
Yeah. No. Our,
or just oils and fish.
We didn't do a risotto or anything.
Yeah.
It was veal parmesan, chicken parmesan. You
there
know,
you go.
That
spaghetti
kind of
meatballs.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
set.
Francese. And, uh-huh. Yeah. And then from there, I went to a hotel and God, this, I was there for a couple of weeks, and they made me the night chef. So I was in charge of the kitchen at night, and I was so over my head.
At a hotel?
Yeah. And I would go and look at books and do
in the
dishes.
City?
No, this was in Secaucus, New Jersey.
Oh, Secaucus. Yeah. We used to drive by that. My grandmother used to say that it was all pigs.
There used to be.
Yeah.
Pigs. I mean, you know, back then in the Meadowlands, you used to go by the Meadowlands and see pheasants, you know, in there.
Yeah, it was like just swamplands, and it stunk.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was
a
smell to it.
Well, it was, you know, all the sulfur coming out of the ground.
Yeah. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
That was natural?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah.
All right.
Sure. it was Jimmy Hoffa decomposing.
Yeah.
That's what it
a
was.
Lot of Jimmy
Hoffa.
That's
all that's exactly. So, and then I worked in a decent restaurant. Doing new American cuisine.
Wait, tell me what happened when you were over your head. So you're working.
Well, no, I would work on these dishes and just kind of nothing. I mean, they all loved it. To me, I look at it and go, "No, this isn't right."
Something's, you had to make the menu.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was in charge of the specials. So I would come up with two or three specials a week or whatever. And
all along the way, you're picking up skills.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah.
You're learning shit.
Yeah, yeah.
You can make a good meatball.
I could do that my mother taught me to do that when I was a kid. So anyway, but then I ended up going to this restaurant called Evelyn's. I'm not Evelyn's. 40 Main Street. And it was a good restaurant.
Where is that?
Actually, this was in Montclair. I'm sorry, Milburn, New Jersey. Short Hills, Milburn. And, I was, a cook there. And then, and that did really well there. I mean, it was a good restaurant. We got 3-star New York Times review, the whole bit.
Italian?
No, it was like new American.
Oh,
you know? And we changed the menu every day. And so we all sat together and just kind of contributed to the menu. And it was a blast. And then I left to go to New York at the Quilted Giraffe and then went back to 40 Main as the chef.
Oh,
after my first chef's job. Yeah.
So tell me how, what are the ranks? Cause what does a sous chef do exactly?
Well, this is the way I put it. You know, people always ask, are you still cook in the kitchen? No, cooks cook in the kitchen. Sous chefs cook a little less. Chefs cook. We really don't cook, but it's our recipes. It's our style of cooking. It's our management style, the whole bit.
So you give up the addiction?
No. It's still there. But if you go to see a classical piece of music, right? You go to see an orchestra play. You know, who gets top billing? The conductor, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're playing a piece of music that was probably written, a couple hundred years ago.
Right.
You don't expect that conductor to jump in the pit and pick up the oboe and start playing or something.
Sure.
No, it would be just chaos.
I don't even know if he knows how, though.
They may. They probably can play instruments.
I'm sure
he can play piano or something.
I don't know if that's true.
Probably. They probably can. But
we don't know that.
But with the chef, you're in the kitchen expediting.
Yeah.
You're, coordinating everything. If you have to go back there and jump behind the line and start cooking, everything comes to a screeching halt. So you want the chef out there, at least coordinating things to a
managing everything.
Yeah.
But that's the big payoff, is you get to not be dirty anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't. It was the Monty Python. How do you know he's the king? He's the only one who ain't got no shit on him.
Because I went over years ago. I've interviewed I guess you're the third or fourth chef. Really, it depends whether you consider Bourdain a chef. So I talked. I don't know if he does. Really.
No, he probably doesn't. Anymore anyway. He used to be.
He claimed that he was sort of a shitty chef.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I've talked to Scott and Alex.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Scott's restaurant and he cooked his the famous spaghetti for me. It's butter. It's butter. It's what the difference is.
Right.
That's the magic.
A little butter and a tomato. Yeah.
That's good though, right?
Yeah, it's fine. It's good. I mean, again, simple. How simple is that?
It's so simple. It's maddening.
It's all about timing, though.
Because you eat at the restaurant, you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
This is insane.
But that's all timing.
What do you mean?
It's when do you put the butter in? When do you know? Once that pasta is cooked and you mix it and you put it in with the sauce and you're finishing it with the sauce, it's just the timing of getting it all right it's just the consistency of the sauce, because the starches of the pasta really play into that as well.
Yeah.
Because you use some of that pasta water.
Right.
That has to go in there.
Yeah.
And so a combination of the tomatoes, the pasta water, fresh herb, and a little bit of butter and some olive oil. And there's a certain moment where it all just comes together and they have to eat it at that point.
You got to eat that right then. Yeah. Doesn't keep.
No. doesn't hold very well.
So do you do that, though, when, you go to someone else's restaurant and you're like, how the fuck did he make that?
There are times, yeah. There was a great chef who, his name was Pierre Gagnier. He had a restaurant in a little town near Lyon called Saint-Étienne. And I would go
there.
Saint-Étienne. It was in France.
Okay.
And I used to go there. And this guy was one of the early guys where I'd look at and go, how the hell did he do this?
Really?
And then I'd go and try to reverse engineer and figure it out.
Was it simple?
No. A lot of it was,
French is complicated though, right?
I remember looking at this one, but this was kind of avant-garde stuff. I remember looking at this one dish and it was a lemon consomme. And, and looking at it and saying, well, this is interesting because lemon's not clear. Lemon juice isn't clear.
Yeah.
Right? But this is crystal clear.
Huh.
So how do you do it? And so I figured out, well, you clarify consomme with egg whites. So right. can you clarify lemon juice with egg whites? The answer is yes.
Oh, you can?
And so, yeah, I'm assuming that's how he did it. That's how I ended up doing it.
It's egg whites or egg shells?
Egg whites. Well, you could put shells and stuff in, but, you know, this, the proteins from the whites, you know, collect all the fat and stuff.
So that's how you...
Yeah. And so it worked. And so, but he was fantastic. Still is a fantastic chef. Yeah.
So, all right. So you teach yourself. You end up at the Quilted Giraffe.
Yeah.
And then you're back at the other place where you do your first head chef job.
Yep.
And as a sous chef, you're working alongside the chef to sort of execute the shit. You're still cooking?
Yeah. Sous means under, so it's just an under chef.
So you're sort of in charge of the kitchen, still getting dirty.
Yeah, you're still getting dirty.
And a cook's a cook.
Cook's a cook.
You tell him what to do, and he should know. All he needs to know is technique.
No, a cook is you tell them what to do, but they always know better. And so they want to do it their way until one day you scream at them enough, and they finally realize that.
And then they quit and become a chef.
Well, something like that. So I opened a restaurant a couple months back. And, my whole thing is like, I think cooks often, the heat's too high, the pans are too hot, and you got to like slow down. You don't need to cook on high heat, but everybody's trying to cook on high heat because they think that's going to cook the food faster and they got to get the food out. And so after, day after day saying lower the flames, lower your oven, doesn't need to be on 500 degrees. And I went and I pulled a plate out of the oven and burnt the hell out of my hands. I just had a fit, started screaming. So the next day, all of a sudden, I noticed the flames were all down, the ovens were all down. And a couple of days later, the cook, the young woman, she came next to me. She goes, you're right. You're right. Thanks.
Your restaurant.
It really doesn't make a difference. Like, yeah, it does. Yeah.
So when do you really start to come into your own as a chef? So it's not out in Jersey.
No, it wasn't. So I left that restaurant.
What was it called again?
It was called 40 Main Street.
And that was in Jersey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I left that restaurant, and I was actually a co-chef with a buddy of mine named Jerry Bryan, who was from Virginia Beach. And he ended up going back to Virginia Beach to open a restaurant. And he opened a restaurant in Portsmouth, which was near Norfolk. And I was kind of between jobs. It was right after, the holidays. And he called me up. He said, I need help. Can you come down here? So I figured I'd go down there for a couple weeks and help out.
Yeah.
I ended up staying for 7 months.
Really?
Right.
In Virginia Beach?
Yeah, and just helped him out. I had a great place on the beach that one of the guys that owned the restaurant.
But you didn't have a family yet?
No. I was 25.
Yeah.
One of the guys who owned it had a condo on the beach. He gave me that to live in. It was a blast. I had a good time. And so then there was a guy who I knew in New Jersey. His name was Dennis Foy. And he had a restaurant in Chatham, New Jersey called the Tarragon Tree. And he was opening a restaurant in New York. And I was in New York at a party for a mutual friend. And the guy took Dennis aside and said, this is the guy you should have to run your kitchen in New York.
He
pointed to me.
Yeah.
And so he called me up, asked me to come. And at the time, I was ready to go to France. And I had 6 months set up in two different restaurants in France.
To learn?
Just to go and stage. We call it stage. You go there in 3 months in one restaurant, three in the other restaurant. And so I said no. And right after that, my father was diagnosed with lung cancer, and we knew that he only had about 3 months to live. And so I decided to stay close to home, not go to France. I took the job. My dad passed away, so I was out of the restaurant for about a month.
Yeah.
And I came back and started working there, and I didn't care for it at all. I didn't like what he was doing.
What was the restaurant?
It was called Mondrian.
Yeah.
And so...
Like, what do you mean? Why didn't you like it?
I didn't like what he was doing. He's a good chef.
Yeah.
But I just... His style of managing the restaurant wasn't for me.
Wasn't the
food. Ex-military guy. Wasn't my thing.
Right.
And so I left, and I ended up going to France.
Yeah.
And I got a call from the owner of the restaurant saying, come back. We want to talk to you. So long story short, I took over the chef's role in the restaurant and started doing my own thing. And within... I think 3 or 4 months, I got a 3-star review from the New York Times. And
that kind of
put me on, yeah, and that put me on the map.
And 3 stars the highest?
No, 4 is, but three at the time was tough. To get 3.
So that's what you're gunning for as a chef.
Four, you gotta be a lot fancier and,
Like Danielle.
It wasn't something that I was a 26-year-old kid from New Jersey. I didn't know 3 from 4. 3 would have been great. 2 would have been good too. I got 3 stars and that just put me on the map.
But it's interesting because that world, it's an insulated world on some level. Mm-hmm. The food world, right?
And back then even more so.
Right.
Pre-internet and.
Yeah, so it was like, it was like a play opening. Right. Who's this kid?
Right.
Colicchio.
Right.
Right. He's got the touch.
Right. It's like, you know, you stand up. You know, there's young guys out there and someone's going to, you know, you're going to hear about someone next year that you never heard about before, right?
Yeah. But the funny thing about stand up, and not unlike chefs, is that, you know, over time they end up doing the same shit over and over again.
Yeah. Well, we do the same thing.
I know.
I carry the same recipes around that I've carried around for, you know, 30 years.
You do have 30-year-old recipes?
Yeah.
Huh. Do you? Yeah. Okay. All right. So now you're a 3-star chef in New York City. And now, is there a scene? Do you guys know each other? Like, did you know Bourdain?
Well, no, I didn't know Anthony. I knew the restaurant that he was working at. I didn't know Anthony at all, but this was, you know, just going back, this is 1992, I think.
Yeah.
And what I noticed is all the chefs that I knew and admired started coming to the restaurant. Like
your restaurant.
Like Daniel Ballou and Jonathan, remember Jonathan Waxman coming in. Just the other chef, Gerard Pango, was a French chef in town. All these chefs started coming in to see what I was doing, which was really cool.
And what were you doing?
I was doing my own thing.
Which was what?
You know, it's hard to explain. I was using the Green Market, you know, so it was kind of farm to table before there was even a notion of farm to table.
Union Square?
Yeah, I was going down there and filling up a truck full of food, you know, 3 times a week. I would hit the fish markets and, you know.
On your own. You were
on my own, yeah. And so I was doing this real sort of produce forward food.
So on Sunday, you'd go down to the Union Square Market?
No, Saturday. We'd go Monday, Wednesday, Saturday.
Okay.
And then I started working with farmers that would bring food to me directly.
And you had fish guys down at where?
At Fulton Fish Market. Yep. And
that's a lot of schlepping.
Yeah, it was. But it was worth it, you know. And so I was doing my own thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of the early reviews were saying just that. It was a new kind of food. I wasn't following anybody, you know. And right now, I think that's the problem with the internet is that you don't have to travel to see someone's food anymore. You can just kind of make a few clicks and try to understand what someone's doing. So trends, you know, fly around very quickly.
Yeah.
And so the restaurant, it wasn't a commercial success. It was a bad business deal, restaurant. So we ended up closing the restaurant.
Yeah.
And in 1991, I was awarded Best New Chef Food & Wine Magazine. And Danny Meyer, chef at the time at Union Square Cafe, he was awarded Best New Chef at the same time. It was 10 chefs every year.
I remember that place. Right. That's still there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, still. Well, he moved recently, yeah. So I met Danny, and the following year I saw him again in Aspen and said, listen, I got to talk to you when I get back home. So I called him up. He said, what's up? I said, I knew he was a fan of the restaurant.
Yeah.
And so I said, I'm closing the restaurant. We should do something together. And he's like, nah, I don't want to open a second restaurant. And a week later, he called me back and said, yeah, let's talk.
Yeah.
And I asked him why did he call back, and he said we had a mutual friend who was a wine distributor and had a wine company, and Danny said, hey, do you know Tom, right? He said, yeah. So he called me and wants to do something together, and he said, well, I'll put it to this way. If Sandy Koufax called and said he wanted to play baseball for your team, you'd probably say yes. So we ended up traveling together before we decided to work together. We took a trip to Italy together. We figured if we could travel together, we could work together.
Yeah, oh, really? You and this other chef?
No, it wasn't a chef. No, he's a restaurateur.
Oh, he's a restaurateur. Yeah, it's a guy who opens restaurants.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had Union Square Cafe.
Yes.
So, you know, you go to Italy and what do you do? You walk around and eat?
We just travel around. Yeah, yeah. And he knew Italy really well, spoke Italian, and his father had a travel business. So when he was a kid, he used to go to Italy quite often, Italy and France, and eat around and, you know, just loved food. Wanted to be a chef, but decided it was too hard and decided he wanted to work in the front of the house.
And he's
considered probably the best restaurateur in the country.
Is that true still?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he also started Shake Shack and made a gazillion dollars doing that.
And that's pretty recent.
Yeah, yeah. So we took a trip together and ate around and just really talked about, we didn't really talk about what we wanted to do. We talked about what we wanted out of our careers, out of our restaurants.
Yeah.
And that sort of led to Gramercy Tavern.
Now, where was that? Because I think I've been there.
Gramercy Tavern is on 20th between Park and Broadway. It's still there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And when did that open?
94, I think it was.
And that was your restaurant? 96,
yeah. He and I did it together, yeah.
And the approach was, you're going to go to the market.
Well, the market was there. Well, yeah. You know, it was American food, but
it's close.
Know, sort of high. Yeah,
oh, I know this
right
place.
Down the street. And it was more high concept, but we had this idea that we wanted to do something that was very comfortable, something that people understood. And this idea of a tavern always kind of, you know, we talked
about. I ate there not too long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we talked about this idea of, you know, a tavern being a place where you can get great food, but you'd go there for various different reasons, whether to have a great meal or whether to just talk about, you know, the politics of the day or whatever it was.
So the concept was sort of a watering hole.
Yeah.
Right.
But with great food and great service.
And is there riffs? Is that like, was that part of the sort of like elevating old standards kind of thing?
Yeah, kind
of. Yeah.
In a way.
That became pretty popular, that whole idea.
Yeah.
Kind of hot rotting, boring shit.
Yeah. There was always that. And for me, it was taking the best of this French technique that I learned, taking this Italian sensibility that I had, and this also American sensibility, and fusing that all together and seeing what came out of that.
What's an American sensibility?
You know, hot rods, man. That's
I know what you're saying.
You know, guitars,
right?
And,
right.
Fenders.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's not a chef sensibility.
Right.
It's just American cultural sensibility.
Right.
Whereas the Italian and the French were actually chef sensibility.
Yes. That's yeah.
So you stay with that for a while. So that's your first restaurant. That's a big deal, and it was a big deal, and you did good.
So
you partnered up with that guy.
Yeah.
Because I don't understand. I don't know if I talked to Alex or Scott about this specifically. Maybe I did about that. You know what? That's the road that you're on. If you can become a good enough chef to open up several restaurants, you that's it, right?
That's a new model. But the old model used to be, you know, go back to, you know, the most iconic New York chef growing up when I was coming up through it was Andre Saltner, who had Lutèce.
Uh-huh.
He lived above the restaurant.
Yeah.
He was in the restaurant. If the restaurant was open, he was in the restaurant.
Yeah.
And that was the model. And it changed, and it kind of changed, not in America, it changed in France when these three-star Michelin chefs started doing their brasseries and their bistros. They did, you know. So
they got their upscale restaurant.
Right.
And it's like, for you regular people that just want a sandwich.
It wasn't even that. It was a way to capitalize on their notoriety, and they were able to bring in other investors. You didn't want to do another three-star restaurant. It takes too much time and too much effort.
Right.
But let's do these other smaller restaurants where you can make the food great, but you don't have to, you know, spend millions of dollars creating atmosphere and you know, artwork and shit like that.
Yeah.
So it was actually, let's bring, you know, better food to the masses. Sure.
Right.
Sure.
So the model changed from living above your restaurant.
Right. To doing multiples, to getting on a plane going to your restaurants.
Yeah. There used to be a restaurant I went to, I think it was on Hudson in New York. Some old Italian guy owned it. He brought wine in from Jersey that he made. And it was, I forget the name.
Really?
I wish I remembered things.
Okay.
Because I would have told you. I was impressed with the guy, but he never, I was mad at him because I wasn't regular enough for him to
got
treat
it,
me.
Got it.
You know, there's that line you got to cross.
Right.
Where you're like, I've been here. Why am I waiting hey, how are you, Mark?
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to go a few times.
Right. You got to be a regular, man. That's what it's about.
It is.
Yeah, sure.
Are you kidding? That's what people, like my mother's boyfriend in Florida, that's what they live for. They don't even care if the restaurant's that good. If you can just be the guy that walks in, like, how are you, John?
Hey, cheers, man. You want to go where everybody knows your name, right? It's true.
That's right. Yeah.
True.
So but you guys are aware of that. When you're in a partnership with that guy, the restaurateur, what's his name again?
Danny Meyer.
Yeah. So that's part of it, right? You in your mind, you're like, who are the guys that are coming in every week? Who do we, you know, who's the families that are coming in every week? And you do that. You make the rounds and you're like,
Yeah. You're there all the time. You know, if you're working on a dish and, you know a few people that you can try it out on, you test drive it on a few people. You're giving stuff away. You're being generous. And but I think that spirit of generosity is, I think what makes a restaurant work. I mean, you have to create regulars if you want to have a successful restaurant.
Right.
So how do you do that?
Right. Yeah. With good food, right? And hospitality.
Yeah. Right.
Saying hi. Being known first names.
Yep. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Acting excited to see people.
Yep.
There he is.
And I'm always terrible at that. I'm not that kind of guy to blow smoke up someone's ass.
No?
It's just not my style.
Yeah, you're sort of intense.
Partly because I can't stand it when it happens to me. Like when that's why I try to keep a low profile if I go to a restaurant. Like I'm not that guy to, you know, have my assistant call up and make a big deal that I'm coming in.
Yeah.
I just want to kind of sneak in.
Yeah, right. So, all right. So you're sort of ahead of the curve on the farm to table idea in a way. But it seemed like a lot of people picked up on that, right?
Yeah. I guess so.
Just because of because I remember by the time I was in New York, well, I was there for a long time, but, you know, chefs were going there. They were going to the market. But they still were able to find shit that was better than I could find. Or maybe they just knew what to do with it. I don't know.
We had farmers. We were regulars for the farmers.
Yeah.
You got to be regular with the farmer, too.
They got the stuff. They save you a good
stuff.
Shit.
Yeah, we get the stuff. I would collect seeds and bring them to farmers and say, can you grow this for me?
Really?
Yeah, back then, yeah. And back then they would do it. Now it's
like,
now,
what do you
now
mean?
I grow my own shit. But
where'd you collect the seeds? What do you mean you collect seeds?
Yeah, you know, back when there were seeds and stuff. You know.
Yeah, like
if you go to Italy, you find like some kind of
tomatoes
or something. Chivisano or something like that. A special tomato and you give them seeds and
And they do it for you?
Yeah.
And you had success in that?
Yeah, sure.
Growing a special tomato?
Yeah.
And you grow your own shit now?
Now I do, yeah.
Where?
I'm a gardener. I have a house.
Oh, for your house.
Yeah, I live in Brooklyn, but I have a house on North Fork on Long Island.
Yeah.
And I have a garden.
And you do, and like big?
It's getting big. It's work.
But do you can? And
I do, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I pickle,
for yourself?
My wife calls me a depression-era housewife, you know, at heart. Yeah. It's great.
So pickling's fun?
Yeah.
Like, what do you pickle?
Well, there's cucumbers, and then there's, you know, green tomatoes or beets.
But that's like, there's a science to it, right? That's almost like chemistry, right?
I don't care. You know, there is a chemistry to it, and I'm not that focused on the chemistry. I know if it's high enough acid and you put it in the jar and you seal it properly, you're good.
And has it worked out?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still here.
Now, well, I didn't think it was going to blow up. You're going to die in a pickling accident.
Poison yourself. No, it all. So far, it's been good. Yeah, I draw my own tomatoes and the whole bit.
What do you mean, draw your own tomatoes? Jar them.
I make sauce and jar it. Yeah.
Oh my God! Yeah. So is this the next wave? Are the product's coming?
No, for me, no, not maybe. Well, not that I'm growing. Not in my backyard, anyway. But for some reason, and I think. You know, my grandparents had, both sets of grandparents gardened and, you know, small. My grandfather used to garden in 5 gallon buckets and it worked. And so.
Pickle things, you mean?
Yeah. And so I had this property is about 3 acres and houses on it. And there was one great area to garden in that was kind of in the back of the house.
Yeah.
And so finally I just bit the bullet and put some boxes together and started gardening. And there's nothing like it for me. It's just so relaxed. I get out there at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's relaxing. I can take my time. And what's cool about the garden is it starts to grow. You just start noticing things different every single day. Like, oh, there's a little zucchini, and 2 days later, it's grown.
How'd that happen?
Yeah, how did that happen?
I was it's last night that happened.
Yeah, yeah.
So it almost looks like something you could have watched happen.
Yeah,
If I just gotten at the right time, I would have just seen this thing blow up.
It's just amazing. And so there's something about just getting in the rhythm of having things grow and knowing when it's time to weed and water and when it's time to, when all of a sudden you're looking and go, what is going on with my zucchini? They looked great 2 days ago and now they're all wilting. What's going on?
Yeah.
And you crack open the stalk and there's a worm the size of your pinky sitting on
it. Oh, you're dealing with the bugs.
Yeah, dealing with the bugs.
Yeah. Yeah. But then there's those days where it's like, I got too many zucchinis.
Well, they have a restaurant for that. I can always bring it to the restaurant and go, there you go.
That's
but
perfect.
We use most of it ourselves.
At home?
Yeah, we do, you know, dinner parties and stuff.
It's fun. So you cook for those,
I cook
right?
at home. I cook at home a lot, especially in the summer.
So you're saying your grandfather actually had a garden in a 5 gallon bucket?
Yes.
Out back?
Yes.
Or whatever?
Yes.
A tomato plant?
He would actually put in a 5 gallon bucket. Yeah.
And that, at that point, it's like, because I always look at people with gardens, I'm like, it looks like you're going to go through that in a day. Your kale came up, so that's one meal.
That's one, yeah. No, I have kale that, actually, it's another green called Spigarella. It's an Italian green related to broccoli. And I just decided to just cut it all down the other day. And I had to blanch it all and then put it in bags and freeze it because there's no way I can eat it all.
Yeah, you can blanch and freeze?
Blanch and freeze, yeah. That green, anyway, it's really hardy, so yeah.
Oh, so it's not going to get all mushy?
No, not at all. No, it'll hold up.
In
fact, after you take it out of the freezer, you probably still have to cook it.
Yeah, because I got two bunches of Rob the other day, and I blanched them, and I sauteed them with garlic and red pepper, and then the pressure was on. I got to eat that shit.
But now, that also, you can blanch that and freeze that, too, and it's fine.
Right, because it's hardy.
Yeah.
I like broccoli, Rob. Yeah. It's seasonal, though, it seems.
Yeah. There's a season for everything.
I know, but you think that they get things from all over, that those seasons are over.
Yeah, but that stuff doesn't grow when it's too hot.
Right. So. Oh, the Rob doesn't? That's what the deal is? It's more of a fall?
It likes to be a little cooler, yeah.
All right, so now tell me so you get done with the Gramercy Tavern, and how do you leave something like that? Because, like, this is the question. Like, there are restaurants that you used to go, that I'd go to, and I'm like, what happened? Well, the chef left.
Yeah.
The menu's still there, but the heart of the thing's gone.
Yeah, you know, so what happened was Danny and I, you know, he opened a few other restaurants and created his group. And I...
Restaurant group.
Yeah, and I was keen to continue to work with Danny, but I wasn't happy with some of his partners that he brought in. And so I opened up a second restaurant called Kraft. And so we decided to work together the best we could. Gramercy was a jointly owned restaurant, and then he was going to do his thing, I was going to do my thing, and at a certain point it just wasn't working out. And I actually worked out a deal where I was buying the restaurant from him, and then last second I said, you know what, here's my number and
Gramercy.
And so I sold my shares.
And he went all Kraft.
I went all Kraft, yeah.
What year was that? Because I can sort of remember that happening. Because then, like, you know, the Kraft thing, that as a brand, it was popping up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we had Kraft Bar, and then Witchcraft, and then Kraft Steak in Vegas, and then we did a Kraft in L.A. So, yeah, we did. We kind of stumbled into a brand. Yeah.
Well, what was the angle on that? Like, see, because this is, so this is your big vision. The Gramercy was the collective vision with Danny, right? Is that his name?
Yeah. So here's the thing. So when I was at Gramercy, I had the food that I was doing, and it was all plated and you know, somewhat intricate and during that time.
Plated, so you mean like fancy liquid? And
Yeah. It looked, you know.
You're Bobby Flaying it a bit?
No, I wouldn't go that far. But it was, when I say plated, you got, and this is important because of what craft was.
Yeah.
So, and there was, you know, five things on a plate. Sort of.
Yeah. Got
and so then craft, you know, it was right around the corner from Gramercy, so I couldn't do the same food I was doing there.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a Thai restaurant in me or something like that. And so I was looking at where I thought the industry was going, and there was so much talk about farmers using farmers. So I said, okay, let's really honor these ingredients.
Yeah.
And so if you want broccoli rabe, can you get a plate of broccoli rabe?
Yeah.
Not broccoli rabe with veal, or just broccoli rabe.
Yeah.
For me, it was peas.
Yeah.
You know, when peas are in season, and they're great, and they're, you know, sweet and delicious, you know, you may have them on three different menu items.
Right.
Well, they come in one day, and they're starchy. What do?
Yeah.
You change all three items? Most likely, you just kind of go with the starchy peas.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? When peas are in season, I want a bowl of peas.
Yeah.
Or morels. I want a bowl of morels.
Yeah.
You know, just simply roast it, and that's it.
Yeah.
You can't get that. There are garnishes everywhere.
Ah.
So then I said, okay, how about we do a restaurant where if it's fish, it's simply roasted, olive oil, some fresh herb, done.
Yeah.
No garnish.
Right.
The garnish, so everything is a la carte. So if you want your fish and then you want those peas and morels, you order that way.
Right.
And that's how, and the idea was that this restaurant was more about the craft of cooking, less about the artistry of cooking.
Oh, okay.
And we really wanted to honor those single ingredients, and that's how it started.
Sort of like you got to do it kind of family style with the,
mm-hmm.
right? Like you're going to get a big
thing. Well, that was it
too.
Mushrooms. So that's what I was saying. So instead of plated, it was family style.
Yeah.
Right.
And you kind of moved the stuff around, and everything seemed like it kind of charred.
Yeah.
In a good way.
In a good way. Okay.
Yeah. No. No, it was not.
Who was burning the food that night?
No, but it seemed like that was part of the angle, that, you know, the roasting business.
Yeah.
Like everything just, it's all simple though.
Yeah, very simple.
Yeah, and well, I like that.
Yeah.
And so where's the empire at now? How do you determine this stuff? Craft, because I'm looking at the list of stuff you have.
Are you on a website?
No, I'm just on I'm just looking at the list on Wiki.
Oh, on Wiki. Oh, God. That's probably not up to date.
Well, no, it's funny. They don't take things off. They just cross them out. Closed.
Yeah, closed. Closed. Great. We closed a few restaurants recently. You know, the real estate in New York is tight these days, and so the landlords are charging crazy rents, and, you know, when your time is up, and you know, they want to charge $60,000 for
a month?
A month for a 120-seat restaurant, it's time to leave.
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
It seems like a lot of the restaurants are gone that used to be in New York.
Yeah.
So they're all closing because of rent or other stuff.
Rent.
So how do you determine, what do you make of that though? Like, is it hard to close a restaurant when it's just in the sense that, do food trends change? Like, do good restaurants survive forever?
Until the rent knocks you out. But, you know, it sucks when you have to walk into a restaurant and tell, you know, 60 people that they're losing their job.
Right, of course.
That's what sucks.
Right. But it's not usually the food that's doing it.
No. Nowadays, it's rent.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the restaurant was busy, but at that point, we would have... It was called Craft Bar. And based on the numbers that we were doing, if we had to pay that kind of rent, we would have lost money.
Yeah.
But at that point, it doesn't make sense.
So what about some of these other places? What's Fowl and Wells?
Well, Fowl and Wells just changed. We changed the name
Fowler
to Temple Court.
Fowler and Wells.
That was we just changed the name. That restaurant opened about 8 months ago. It's in the Beekman Hotel.
Uh-huh.
And as it turns out, Fowler and Wells, they were two publishers that worked in, the building was built in 1835.
Yeah.
And so these two, we named the restaurant after these two guys that, you know, worked there. We kind of did a little history research. And they were publishers, and they published journals of psychology and a few other things too, but they were also phrenologists.
Uh-huh.
And
feel the head for the problems?
Yeah, something like that. But, you know, there was also, phrenology was used for a lot of different things. It was also used to try to prove that the Africans were a separate race.
Yeah.
And so I knew that, but it was this debunked pseudoscience, and I figured, you know, what the hell. I knew it was also used by abolitionists to prove the opposite, and Black Writers of the Day used to prove the opposite. But as it turns out, the Fowler of the Fowler and Wells was the guy.
Yeah.
So we had to change the name of the restaurant.
You got flack?
We got in a review from the New York Times, they kind of...
said, it's a little insensitive.
A little insensitive, and I, you know, the following day decided to change the restaurant. It took about 8 months to come up with a new name and the work changes.
And
so
what's the menu
it's
there?
It's called Temple Court.
Temple Court.
Well, that's a restaurant where we were, where I went back to, at least when I started cooking, where food was more based on sauces, you know, stocks and sauces versus vinaigrettes and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Got rid of the microgreens, got rid of the swooshes, and you know, and it's a little more basic, where it's sauce, garnish, meat, fish, whatever.
Yeah.
And then also we reworked a lot of the classics. So lobster Thermidor we reworked, and oysters Rockefeller and things like that.
Oh yeah, how do you rework oysters Rockefeller?
You take it out of the you take it out of the shell. Number one.
Yeah.
We use
spinach.
Well, we use watercress instead of spinach, lightened up the sauce, and got rid of the cheese.
Huh.
So it's just a lighter version.
Watercress is good.
Yeah, and same thing with the lobster Thermidor. We just kind of, you know, the sauce doesn't have cream in it. We lightened it up.
How's it going?
It's going great.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's going really well.
Wait, so you've got two restaurants in Vegas?
Yeah. There's Heritage Steak and Craft Steak. Yeah.
And they're both you?
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Not a whole lot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What is it about?
A little bit.
How do you treat steaks? What's your angle on steaks?
Simple salt, pepper, just roast them up and that's it. Yeah.
Buy
good meat. That's it. You got to buy good meat.
Double Porterhouse.
Double Porterhouse is great. You got to buy good meat.
You know, I used to have a good Double Porterhouse. There's another place that closed down the meatpacking. Marcelleria.
Uh-huh, sure. That closed?
Yeah.
Man. Yeah, that was good. Yeah,
right?
See, I moved out 2 years ago, so I don't.
Oh, yeah. They did the Rob.
Yeah.
And just a Double Porterhouse.
Mm-hmm.
The best.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
So just buy good meat, high heat.
High to start and then turn it down.
Right.
Yeah. I always say high heat's not your friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what do you think about the classic steak? Do you ever go to Luger's?
I haven't been in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very specific, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I like it, but yeah. I haven't been in a long time.
No, of course not, but like, is it? Do you respect it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, why not? They've been there for 100 years. You have
it's
to
butter, right?
Butter plays a big part in that. Yeah, they get great meat. Butter plays a big role. Yeah. But I like the fact that they do one thing. Yeah. Porterhouse. That's it.
Yeah,
it's and they get away with that. Yeah, it's good.
And what about the nature? Is it like we'll get to TV in a second, but like because you're out here for the Emmys, right?
Yeah.
Are you nominated?
Yeah, we're nominated
for what?
Yeah. Best reality show.
Oh, for Top Chef?
It's a primetime nomination.
It's been on forever now.
15 seasons.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
15 seasons of you tasting things and hurting people's feelings.
Well, a little bit. We also, you know, we launch a lot of careers too.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
But 15 seasons.
What about the competitive? You guys got to be competitive.
Chefs?
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
Man.
Yes. There is competition, but it's friendly competition.
It is?
Yeah. Yeah.
You never like sit around and go like, nah, Jeff Zakarian's like, I don't
know. No.
He's wearing his bow tie.
Yeah. No, that's his thing. It's fine. He's a good guy.
No, he is. He seems like a good guy. Yeah. But I did eat at his restaurant in Florida when I was on a real, Chopped craze. So I would go to, you know what I mean?
Okay.
No, I was watching it.
Yeah. Okay.
And it was teaching me how to cook.
Okay.
In a way. Yeah, but I liked it, and I liked the personalities, and I went to his restaurant in Florida, and I was like, this is not good. Yeah. I didn't have a good meal. And I'm like, I got to go to the one in New York. Yeah. I never did. But like, who is your generation? Is it like Bobby?
No, I'm a little older than Bobby. My generation.
Really?
My generation was Alfred Portale. He's a little older than I am. Thomas Keller. Daniel Ballou.
Daniel's your generation?
Yeah. He's slightly older than I am, but I was, because I kind of made it, you know, that when I was 26, I was pretty young.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Bobby's younger than I am. Jeffrey's my age, Jeffrey Zakarian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you guys knew each other coming up?
Yeah. I mean, you know, working in New York, we kind of all know who, you know, you sniff around,
sure.
We know who everybody is. Yeah.
And do you compliment each other?
Yeah.
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 Like, you know, you're like, yeah, it has a good job on that. Like, you taste each other's shit. Cause, yeah, I mean, like, that's the one thing that those kind of shows, I don't know, does Top Chef do it? Well, you do it. Well, you're sitting there with chefs and you're tasting shit.
Yeah.
And you can appreciate things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice, right?
Yeah. You know, I think that, I mean, I appreciate everybody. There's a lot of people doing great stuff that you'd never hear of.
Yeah.
Chefs like, you know, Jonathan Benno, Marco Canora. These are, you know, chefs doing great food in New York, but they're not on TV.
Right.
And so, there's a lot of you know people that are just doing amazing stuff that you just don't hear of, and So yeah, but there's a respect that we all have.
All right.
You know, I don't, you know, there's not a whole lot of sniping. Some stuff on, you know, sometimes you walk in. The problem right now is with, things have changed. You know, yeah. It used to be when we were coming up, there were gatekeepers. And certain people, mostly magazine editors and things like that, and writers, who you didn't hang out with. And if they decided that they liked you, and that you were doing some great stuff,
yeah.
They'd write about you.
Yeah.
And so you got buzz, and it was worthwhile.
There was a handful of people.
Nowadays, buzz is generated for a lot of different reasons. And yeah. So a lot of times you go into a restaurant and you hear this amazing buzz, and it's like you go there and go, really? This is it?
Right.
Not that it's bad, but this is what everybody's going crazy about?
Yeah.
All right. Like, I can't, you know, decide, you're going to go there, your mind's going to be blown. You go there and go, now my mind's not blown. It's good, but I'm sorry, but it's food. It's just food. I think maybe after a while you're so jaded and you go, it's just food. You know,
no, I don't know if that's true. I think the point is that people can generate buzz that is not solely based on the critical palate of somebody you respect.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, those guys are gone, really.
But I think it's just that we need someone, the internet needs someone to talk about and someone to, you know, that's going to be hot for the next 3 months.
Right. Or, yeah, right. And that's it.
That's it.
But it's true that cultural criticism on all levels, you know, whether it be food or, you know, painting. Mm-hmm. I don't know so much about painting, but just film.
Yeah,
that it's just diminishing the standard bearers are kind of gone.
Right, and there's all user generated reviews now.
Yeah,
and
it's it. That's yeah. It's just it's. I guess it's more democratic, but you know, what do the people know? Wait, you need a few snobs.
You do need a few. Just a few.
Yeah,
not a lot. A few.
Yeah, just a few respectable snobs. Yeah. To determine the. So the TV thing, so that feeds everything else. How many, do you know how many restaurants you have open right now?
Yeah. We have 8 restaurants.
Okay. And those are ones that are your thing?
Yeah. Mine are licensing deals of the hotels and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you have a licensing deal, like, is that a deal at the MGM? Is that a licensing mm-hmm. deal? But you what is your responsibility then?
Well, we design the restaurant.
Yeah.
We design the kitchen. We put the menu in. It's my food. It's my management style. But they build it and they own it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But you got to check in occasionally?
Yeah,
make
an
appearance?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's say hi.
I mean, more so when we first open up.
Right.
When we first opened up, I was there for, you know, pretty much 3 months straight through.
But like, are you in contact with the chef?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
Does he have problems? Is there a problem? Sort of like
no. The guy, the chef there, is funny. Michael. He was our first grill cook. And I remember the first day I looked and said, "This guy's going to last about 2 weeks."
Your first grill cook where?
At the restaurant when we first opened up.
Yeah.
So this was 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And I really said, "This guy's going to last 2 weeks."
Yeah.
He's a chef now.
Yeah.
And he's fantastic.
Oh, that's great.
He's just, you know, he's just one of these guys. He's kind of quiet. That, you know, we just did his job and
Yeah,
I never said much, but you know, I couldn't tell whether he was excited about cooking because he was just kind of quiet.
Yeah,
and he's just fantastic.
And how is Vegas as a market now?
It's
still
great.
Good.
It's great. Yeah,
it holds up.
We're back to pre-recession levels.
Oh yeah,
yeah, we're finally back there. Yeah,
so the economy's good, despite what we're being told.
The economy's good. I mean, the rest of the world's going to shit. The economy's good. The economy's great.
Well, that's the other thing. Like, you were in New York for so many years. You must have dealt with Trump when he was just a character.
Yeah, he wasn't a foodie. I always knew who he was. And
he never came into the restaurant?
No, he wasn't a food guy. I would get calls every now and then from his organization saying, "We're doing a project and we'd love you to come there." And I would say, "You're building a restaurant, right?" "Oh, no, no. We're the best. You're going to come." No.
We're the best.
We're the best. You kidding me? This would be the greatest hotel in the world and you got to come. And you should be honored to open a restaurant and spend money in our place. Yeah. No.
Yeah, it's
I don't know.
Relentlessly scary. I see you're engaged with it.
A little bit.
But it's the righteous thing to do. You got to push back. But like, okay, so the TV show, like, that's been good for you.
Yeah.
And here's a question. You've started a lot of careers. You like the people you work with. Are you a producer on it? You are. At this point, what is it about the cooking an egg?
that's kind of open ended. What about cooking an egg?
But I mean, it's like, you know, there's all this talk about the perfect egg.
Yeah, because it's hard to cook.
Really?
Yes and no. It can be.
They did it on one of the other shows. They do Iron Chef or what?
Yeah.
What's a guy, Michael? What's a guy from Cleveland?
Michael Simon.
He's a good chef.
Yeah,
right?
His
sous chef has a great fucking restaurant right next to his. It's called the Green... Oh, what the hell is it called? Greenhouse Tavern.
Yeah.
There you go. Jonathan Sawyer.
Jonathan Sawyer, of course. Jonathan's a great guy. Jonathan actually, he's really supportive. I have a organization I co-founded called Food Policy Action.
Yeah.
And we are routinely up, in D.C. on the Hill, meeting with representatives, you know, trying to push this idea of better food.
Oh, really?
So we fight the fight for people that are hungry in this country, for better farming practices, more, transparency in the food system. And Jonathan's one of the guys who actually comes and works with me up on the Hill. Yeah.
So I didn't realize that. Yeah. You spend a lot of time in Washington doing that?
More than I want to, yeah.
And what does that entail?
We're a C4. Uh-huh. I'm an unpaid, unregistered lobbyist.
Yeah.
And we don't have clients.
Right.
And so we just go and meet with, House members or staff, are their staff.
Uh-huh.
And, usually around farm bill or school lunch or, we were heavily involved in labeling. Uh-huh. Not that I'm anti-GMO, but I'm pro-labeling.
Right.
Very active around school lunch, trying to get more money for school lunch, higher quality food for school lunch. Working really hard on my wife is a filmmaker and she co-directed a documentary called A Place at the Table that came out about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, about hunger in this country.
Okay.
And that gave me a real platform to sort of go and talk with representatives about making sure that we have robust nutrition programs in this country.
And so, have you engaged since this president?
Yeah, the problem right now is you go there and you'll meet with staff members and stuff, but there's no one. So, for instance, I was, this was confirmed just 2 days ago. I was with Secretary Vilsack, who was the head of the USDA, and Sonny Perdue, who's now the head of the USDA.
Yeah.
There's no one under him. They haven't appointed anybody.
Uh-huh.
So there's no one to talk to. So there's no one writing policy right now. So it's just bizarre. There's just – the government's just not functioning because no one's there.
And those are jobs that he needs to fill, president.
Yeah. And so what happens is usually when you're running and you win a nomination, I'm reading Hillary's book right now, and for months they were saying who's going to fill these positions because they knew how many positions it was, like 500 plus positions.
They're doing it on purpose.
And I don't know if they're doing it on purpose or they just didn't think about it because they didn't think they were going to win.
Yeah.
So there was just like, and he's not someone who knows how to govern. That's not how government works. And so there was never a thought of the one it was really interesting. Jared Kushner, when he was taking a walk through. Asked, well, how many of these people are staying?
Yeah,
and
right.
None of them.
Yeah,
you don't just take over a company.
Yeah.
these people are all gone.
Yeah.
You've got to fill these roles.
I wonder how much of it is on purpose to hobble the government and how much of it isn't.
Yeah, I don't think so.
So there's literally no one to go address issues with?
There's no one to talk to right now. No.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. So you could talk to the members of Congress, and they're involved in writing policy as well, but it's...
No policy coming out.
Nothing
of these
coming out. There's no,
the
that's, and that's a good thing though, because there's nothing happening. They can't get anything done because there's no one to actually write policy. So that's fine.
All right. As long as
right?
It's not getting worse.
Right. Right.
In that particular one area,
it's getting worse. I think there's a lot of stuff going on with the EPA.
I actually think
they should start calling the IEPA, the Industrial Environment Protection Agency, because that's the only environment.
Or the anti-environment.
Well, it's the only environment that protection is industry.
Yeah.
It certainly isn't the environment. It's not the Earth's environment.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Back to the egg. So,
egg.
I just saw, I don't remember what show it was on, but why is it so important that there's this idea about the egg?
A lot of chefs, especially the old school French chefs, said that's like, Andre Saltner, going back to Andre Saltner, if you were cooking, wanted a job in his kitchen, he would say, okay, make an omelet.
Yeah.
And there's a way to make a French omelet.
Yeah.
And then there's two kinds of omelets. There's a country omelet and a classic omelet. And
how are you at those?
I could do them. I can handle that. But a classic omelet doesn't have any color on it.
Uh-huh.
But it's all cooked and fluffy and
yeah.
It's all about timing and about knowing how to do it. And a lot of people are just never trained to do it properly. So you tell, 15 contestants that come in, like, make an omelet, and most of them will screw it up.
The basic omelet means no color involved.
It's not brown.
Yeah.
Because that toughens the egg.
Yeah.
And so it's just this beautiful, yellow mass of eggs that are perfectly...
Nothing in it?
No.
Yeah.
Typically, it's not. Typically, it's just maybe some fresh herbs, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's not... The American omelet's more of a stuffed omelet.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what's the other kind?
There's a French country, there's a classic, and then
what's
a country.
The country?
The country omelet has, there is a little color on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so
that's anyway. But that's it. I mean, it's, my 8-year-old the other day, we have chickens out and run around too.
Yeah.
Dad, I got to learn how to cook an egg.
Yeah.
So I taught him how to cook an egg, and he said, I need another one. And so 4 eggs, because he wanted to cook them, which is fine.
But, yeah.
So he wants to, 8-year-old wants to learn how to cook an egg.
But was he coming at it in the same way I was, or he just wants to learn how to cook an egg?
He wants to learn how to cook an egg.
Oh, he doesn't.
I think it's just like,
you didn't,
like, I know if I asked
bring
that,
him through the omelets.
No, no, it's like, if, no, it was fried. He liked them over easy. So, we did that.
Oh, yeah. good. You didn't break them?
He broke a few.
You
got to break a few. Yeah.
So now is the show coming back?
Yeah. We shoot usually May through June, and we're in Colorado this season. And
why Colorado?
We try to go to different locations every season, and we hadn't been to Colorado, so it's we're in Denver, Telluride, and Aspen.
Okay.
And it should be a good
season. It's a big foodie culture Aspen, probably, right?
And Denver. Denver's actually come a long way. There's some great restaurants there now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I got to go.
Yeah, there's a place called Mercantile I liked a lot.
Well, by the time, I guess, we put this up, Mercantile. Okay. Yeah. By the time we put this up, we'll have won or we'll have lost.
I'm practiced just happy to be not. This is our 11th nomination. We won one.
But you're happy that you come out and see everybody.
It's not my industry, so, what I find really interesting is that, there's a whole group of Hollywood type people who love the show.
Yeah.
And I'm always just shocked at who comes up and says, oh my God, I love the show. It's like, really?
Yeah.
You watch this?
It's great.
Like, Liev Schreiber, you really watch this?
It's great.
And he's like, yeah, I really watch it.
Yeah.
It's great. And so, it's pretty cool.
I get that too with this show.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm always sort of like, what? You're listening to it?
Yeah.
Like on your way to work?
Yeah. Yeah. So, no, it's a blast because I don't consider myself part of the industry.
Yeah.
And yet I am.
Sure.
And part of the Hollywood industry. And so it's kind of cool. Yeah.
And do you drop by the restaurant? Or you did last night? You did.
Yeah, I was there last night. Tonight we're doing a charity event on the beach. And so I'll probably go and hang out with my guys and do that.
But you're cooking on the beach for charity?
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like an ordeal.
It's like one of those walk around events. Nah, we have it figured out. Yeah. We have a station and people walk around and we're doing that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, great talking to you, man.
Yeah.
Good luck tonight.
Yeah, thanks.
Good guy. Solid dude. Don't forget, the Emmy and Golden Globe winning comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm returns to HBO for its 10-episode 9th season Sunday, October 1st at 10 p.m. Eastern. It's Larry David as Larry David, which means this is the show where you're going to get the most Larry David version of Larry David that you can possibly get. Cast favorites Cheryl Hines, Jeff Garland, Susie Essman, and J.B. Smoove are all back, as well as series veterans like Richard Lewis, Bob Einstein, Ted Danson, and Mary Steenburgen. Catch the return of Curb Your Enthusiasm on Sunday, October 1st at 10 p.m. Eastern on HBO. So I'm going to plug my gold top directly in to the champ with the wah-wah pedal again. Because I enjoyed it, and you can listen or you can't or don't. I don't. It doesn't matter. I'm gonna play. I'm gonna fucking play. I'm not a man.